defeat, unbeatable. In victory, unbearable. That was Winston Churchill's judgment on Field Marshal Bernard Montgomery after the war. And I'm here in Southwark House, near Portsmouth, in the room, the map room, which has this fabulous map on the back wall that we'll talk about a bit later. And this room is the room where all the planning for the biggest amphibious operation in history came together, D-Day, on the 6th of June, 1944. And we're here to talk about Bernard Montgomery and his role, amongst other things, in the D-Day operation. And I'm delighted to say that we're joined by General Lord David Richards. Lord Richards was Chief of the General Staff, head of the Army, and Chief of the Defence Staff, head of all of the armed forces, and has a very long and distinguished military career, including a number of combat operations in his portfolio. And so David is going to join me here to talk about General Montgomery, Bernard Montgomery. David, welcome. This room is something, isn't it? It's resonant to be here and sit here in front of the map and think this was Montgomery's achievement to have planned on behalf of the 21st Army Group this massive operation.
Well, it is fantastic to be here. I haven't been here for about 20 years, but walking in and looking at that map has brought back all sorts of memories, not least, obviously, of Montgomery himself. What a difficult but brilliant man he was. And I'm sure we'll explore Overlord, as this operation is known, in more detail later in our conversation. But it is very, very evocative and means a hell of a lot to me.
As a military person, this room is important. This building is important. Mm.
Well, I mean, you know, to know that we are sitting in a room that Eisenhower came into all the time as the general, Monty was here, Tedder, all the great characters associated with really not just Overlord and the invasion of Normandy, but with the Second World War as a whole.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Monty, Montgomery. He's born in 1887. He's a very unhappy young man. He has a difficult childhood. His parents are neglectful. His mother was frankly unhinged and beat all her children. He's a very unhappy man, and he escapes at the age of 20 to Sandhurst. And by his own admission, he's a bully at Sandhurst. He runs a gang at Sandhurst. He almost gets thrown out. But the army saves him because it gives him that sense of discipline, and his lack of charm, his lack of emotional intelligence doesn't matter as much in the army, not in those days, as it might in other walks of life. But how would you assess his strengths and weaknesses, and particularly as a commander? What are the strengths and weaknesses as his personality strikes you in the command role?
Well, you grow into command, but you know, you're as a second lieutenant, he started to learn his trade, and I'm sure he learned a lot of lessons in that early period. But I think his single-mindedness and self-conviction were particular attributes that stood him in good stead all the way through his career. I think we might come back to it, but much of the modern British Army, although in some respects it would see itself as being completely different to the rather hidebound army that we're talking about in the 20s and 30s in particular, I think much of the modern British Army owes itself to Monty. Things like focus on fitness, detailed planning. The army wasn't very good at all that in some respects. And only just before the First World War had a general staff for the first time. And you know all these things much better than me. But I think Monty brought all that discipline and focus on planning, and most of all, as an individual, his self-conviction and belief in his own brilliance,
yes.
Which in many respects was awful, and you hinted at some of the things people thought of it, but in some respects was absolutely vital when we had commanders who were full of self-doubt. He had no self-doubt, and he drove his army, or his platoon, I'm sure, as a young second lieutenant, hard, but with a very, very good focus.
And as a young lieutenant, there was something in October 1914 in the First World War. He leads a bayonet charge, the first Battle of Ypres. He's wounded, seriously wounded, lying out in the open. One of his men comes out to rescue him, and he is killed. And this man falls across him. So he lies all day there with a dead man on top of him, absorbing more sniper rounds. During the night, Montgomery is pulled in. He's expected to die. They dig a grave for him. He pulls through. As a result of that injury, he doesn't then go back to the front. He wanted DSO for his actions that day. Quite unusual for a lieutenant, yeah. DSO. But nevertheless, he then goes on to the planning staff at GHQ. And so from being quite a young officer, he spends the First World War as a planner. And that seems to influence the rest of his career.
I think he was very critical of much of the planning around him and learnt a huge amount from that period. I mean, first of all, I think it does explain to some degree his, I think, correct aversion to taking more than absolutely necessary minimum casualties. Yeah. And you see that play out into the Second World War. And he was very critical, and your book brings this out, of many of the First World War generals who seemed to be a little cavalier about that. I mean, I'm sure as individuals they weren't, but that's the impression he got, other than Plumer. I think he's a great fan of Plumer.
Yes, he was.
He was
in
more
the Second
maneuverist.
Army. Yeah.
So I think that period inevitably does impact on his subsequent career and the values that he possessed about, you know, casualties and much else.
Let's just jump forward to the Second World War, the Battle of France, 1940, and the withdrawal to Dunkirk. I mean, Montgomery handles the 3rd Division pretty well in the withdrawal, but in that sense, he establishes the reputation with people like Alan Brooke, his corps commander, who then, of course, becomes really important, becomes chief of the Imperial General Staff after Dunkirk.
Yeah, I think Monty, although he didn't, the 3rd Division didn't play a hugely significant role militarily, he trained them assiduously. When other divisional commanders were allowing their soldiers time off in Paris or whatever, Monty, you know, kept his finger absolutely on the pulse of what would be required and trained them hard, particularly things like physical fitness and so on and so forth, and rehearsed them in the manoeuvres he thought would be required. And those were virtually exactly what was required. So he came away, having not been a major corps commander like Brooke was, who was 3rd Division was in his corps and went on to be CIGS, as you say. But he earned his reputation there within the army and was very much, if you like, the basis of of his subsequent success.
And after Dunkirk, poor John Gort is commander of the whole BEF, British Expeditionary Force, and Montgomery then goes to the chief of the Imperial General Staff, as it then was, General Ironside, as a 2-star general, talking to a 4-star general, and rubbishes the whole command structure. He tells Ironside what worked and what didn't, who should be promoted and who shouldn't, and he's very hard on poor John Gort, who was, you know, dealt a pretty awful hand in 1940. And that almost is an act of insubordination, isn't it? 2-star telling tales to a 4-star?
Well, I've said to others, if people who were subordinate to me came in and gave me that sort of lecture, I'd make sure, and I hope that no one else was in the room, because then that does aggravate things. But I'd say, just call me sir. Put sir at the end, you can say anything new. And maybe Ironside had that sort of relationship with Monty. I'm not certain, because, you know, it was less common in those days. But I think he had earned a very good reputation, albeit for a limited military success in France in 1940. And he could probably get away with it, mostly because he was right. But yeah, it was quite a necky thing to do.
And then Alan Brooke becomes Chief of Imperial General Staff, and Brooke is a great admirer of Montgomery, and he protects him for the rest of the war, really. He gets him off the hook several times by either moderating what Monty's doing or advising Monty to say this rather than that. I mean, Monty would not have been as successful without Brooke above him.
No, no doubt about it. I mean, Brooke was his great protector and advocate, and Monty was a pretty close-run thing on occasions, because Monty was not easy. Churchill didn't really like Monty that much, but recognised his talents. Brooke, this hugely talented, strategically-minded general, understood that they had to put up with it, because in Monty they had an exceptional general.
Let's jump the story ahead to the thing that makes Monty's reputation as a general, which he goes to the Middle East. Auchinleck is relieved of his command, in effect, and Churchill appoints a second go, actually. It wasn't going to be him in the first instance, but he appoints Montgomery to command the Eighth Army, which is broken. It's been retreating. It held in the first Alamein, but didn't do as well as it should have done. He makes Churchill makes Alexander the theatre commander above Montgomery, which is a reversal of their previous relationship. But Churchill sees that Alexander's the man for the theatre, Montgomery's the man for the battle. And Montgomery fights then the Battle of Almhalfa, and then the Battle of Alamein. And you know, you've studied this endlessly. What do you make of his tactical appreciation, his operational level warfare appreciation? How do you assess him at Almhalfa and Alamein?
Well, there's a dimension to his personality which we might talk about, you know, which was both difficult but quite inspirational if you were in the Eighth Army, as it became. I think Almhalfa, in many ways, was the more significant battle because that stabilised the front. And Rommel, after that, largely for logistic reasons, didn't have the capacity to go any further east. And that was a very clever battle that took a lot of self-control and understanding. The great thing about Monty, in many respects, I'd say the most important thing, is he had a really good feel for what his troops could do. He would have loved, arguably, to manoeuvre in the way Rommel had a reputation for doing so successfully. And the German army, the Africa Corps of that period, were good enough to do it. But actually, the British army at that stage didn't probably have the capability to do it.
And it was a conscript army, though.
And it was a largely conscript army. It was new. It lacked the doctrinal basis and deep understanding that the Germans had been developing for 10, 15 years. So I think his great trick was to understand what it could do, what it might achieve, what it couldn't do. And he designed Alamein also on that basis. It was a rather cautious battle. It didn't expect the British Army to manoeuvre in sort of dramatic, dynamic way after the break-in battle. Indeed, he paused, arguably, wrongly, because he just wanted to, which, by the way, led the Americans to see him as an overly cautious general. I think many of Monty's defenders and explainers would say, actually, he knew what he could ask his army to do, and he wasn't going to give Rommel a chance to exploit its weaknesses.
And he didn't want to overextend himself.
Didn't want, and logistics were all, as we will see here, you know, I used to tease audiences when I would talk to them in the army that professionals taught logistics, he knew that. And of course, that was Rommel's great Achilles heel too in the Western Desert by then.
And as a gunner, you must appreciate, I'm sure, Monty's appreciation in Almhalfa and at Alamein of artillery and using tanks dug in, hull down, as artillery. I mean, he understood the value of putting artillery first before the infantry. Rather than in the First World War, put the infantry first and then somehow the you know, the armour follows. No, he put it the other way around. Yeah. The armour starts and the infantry follows up.
I think this goes back to his the lessons he'd learned in the First World War about casualties. I mean, I think there were 12,000 killed at Alamein, something like that, know better, which was more than he had planned for and hoped for. But there could have been many, many more killed if he hadn't played this rather cautious hand. At the end of the day, it was successful, and no one can decry the fact that he pushed Rommel all the way back, eventually out of North Africa completely.
And when we think about the North Africa campaign, and then that leads on to the Sicily campaign and then Italy, and he never really believed in the Italian campaign. He just didn't think it was strategically significant enough. But this is where his ego seems to get in the way of relations with the United States. And he seems then to really antagonize his American colleagues, particularly Patton.
George Patton. Now, I think Patton probably annoyed a lot of other people too. So you have two huge egos there. Yeah. In fact, who is the most egotistical theme for a good book, actually? Yeah. Because, you know, I used to give a talk at the Staff College on Patton. So I've got a few of his one-liners somewhere deep in my brain. But yes, I mean, there's no doubt that up till that point, he was essentially annoying British counterparts and contemporaries. And people like Orkin Leck did not like him for all the reasons we've been discussing, ego, somewhat a little bit pompous sometimes and alienated lots of people. But it didn't really matter because he had Brooke protecting him, and Churchill, you know, above that was tolerating him. Strafer Gott was the original selection for Eighth Army. If he hadn't been...
he's killed in a plane crash.
Exactly. Who knows what might have happened. But I think for the first time, you get to Sicily and you saw it to begin with, even in while they were still in North Africa, a rivalry that their egos stoked up even more. And in Sicily... it was really the last time the British and Monty called the shots. Mm. And the cautious Eisenhower, I think, was still feeling his way, and he went with it. That relationship has, to some degree, poisoned the overall relationship between the British and American armies. I mean, great men like Eisenhower, here we are in this room, got over that and above it. But I think for the first time it started to have significant effects, if you like, playing right out onto the battlefield.
Yeah. And so that brings us, I think, logically to Montgomery's, I think, triumph, in my view, which is all about D-Day and the planning. I mean, D-Day, any amphibious operation, as you well know, since you were in charge of one in 2000 in Sierra Leone, is the most difficult sort of operation that any army or force can conduct, the most risky. And it's won and lost in the planning phase. And Montgomery was in charge of the planning. And so he's taken to, or he's brought to Marrakesh in December 1943, and Churchill gives him an outline of the plan as it then existed, Crossack, to invade the French coast. And Montgomery is given a few hours on New Year's Eve to have a look at it and come back with ideas. And he spends all of New Year's Eve, while Churchill is off celebrating the New Year, 1943-44, Montgomery types up a long report, rubbishing the plan, it won't work, and he comes up with his own outline. And in January 1944, he's at St. Paul's School in Hammersmith, his old school as it happens, and that is the new headquarters of the 21st Army Group. The plan is presented again, the Crossack plan, and publicly, in front of everyone, he rubbishes it again, and he says, we've got to start again. And what he came up with overnight on New Year's Eve is basically the Overlord plan, which is the plan on the map behind us. And in my sense, and I'd be interested in your view, I know you were a very assiduous planner, and you believed in preparation. But in a way, I think, you know, the D-Day battle was won or lost in the planning stages. And Montgomery had fought his battle by the 7th of April, 1944, because that was when the planning was finished. Couldn't be changed after that because of the difficulty of changing anything in time for D-Day. That must have been quite a judgment to make, to put Montgomery in charge of it.
Yes, I think it was. But you see, as we've been hinting, at that point, his star was absolutely in the ascendant, if not reached its zenith. He had proved in the Western Desert and arguably also in Sicily and Italy, which was successful, becoming a grinding match, that he knew his business probably better than anybody.
Yeah.
I think he was spot on. I mean, I've looked at that. General Morgan was a very well-intentioned bloke, but he didn't have the practical experience that Monty had. And the original plan was too narrow. There wasn't enough mass. I think it was helped in its development by the logistic planning that had not at that point really occurred. And they realized that just how big it had to be to sustain it after the first day, if you got them all ashore. But I think I'd agree with you entirely. I mean, in many, many respects, and we forget that at this stage and right through to the end of August, the operation was run and commanded by Monty, not by Eisenhower. And although we can be very critical of some of the tactical errors and the time it took, the essential plan, I would argue, was followed. It didn't help that Monty sort of didn't sort of acknowledge where it had been delayed and that the enemy has a vote and all that sort of thing. But the essence of the plan was sound. And if he'd just been a little bit, shown a little bit more humility, even if it was just amongst those that were at his level, I think it, his reputation would be quite different. But as it was, that early animosity between the Americans and we, which we really mean Monty and the Americans, grew in intensity towards the end of that time in particular. But even my American colleagues, who are all a little bit more than ambivalent about Monty, I have to say, you know, people like Dave Petraeus.
Even today.
Yeah. Whereas I, when you look at Patton, as we've talked about, I think he was a great tactical commander, Patton. Huge ego problems as well. But Monty, in terms of his planning and his ability to stick to a plan and understand what the intent was and holding people's toes to the fire, notwithstanding what was happening around, I think that's pretty special.
Yeah. And it comes together. I mean, this is the operations room for D-Day. It comes together in the room next door at 4:30 in the morning on the 5th of June, pre-dawn meeting. The weather had been terrible. James Stagg, the group captain, meteorologist, civilian, in fact, been given the rank to make people take notice of him. And he gave them a 24-hour window the following day on the 6th of June. And in the room next door, they all assemble, only four or five of them. And Montgomery is the only one who's not properly dressed. They've all got battle dress on. He turns up in his yellow turtleneck sweater and corduroy trousers. Typical. He was never properly dressed. And they sit in that room, and Eisenhower stands up, and he walks around, and he asks everybody what they should do. And it's not unanimous. Montgomery says, you've got to go. The others don't all say that. And then Eisenhower stands for a while, thinks, and he said, okay, let's go, quite quietly. And the whole thing begins to ramp up from there on. And this, in a way, this is what Monty's been waiting for, because he then goes over to France on D plus one. He's there in his headquarters, and he's running the Battle of Normandy. And Eisenhower doesn't arrive until it's appropriate to set up his command center. So Eisenhower isn't there for a good few days, and Monty is the first man, as it were, to command as soon as the D-Day operation's over. And D-Day, we should record the fact, goes much, much better than anyone could have imagined, because the risks were huge. Because it went so well, we take it for granted. But every time I've looked at D-Day, for the research I've been doing on it, I was staggered by the degree of risk that was being taken.
I know, and it's interesting that Monty is viewed as a risk-averse character, and to some degree he was. But I think, like all good generals, he'd sort of worked out that he could contain those risks if the plan was up to it. And the plan, in order to, I mean, the big risk was a counterattack along the coast, if you like, in from the southeast. And the debate within the German army about whether that should be done, you know, soon, early or later, was effectively lost by Rommel, who had wanted to counterattack very early on, and the armour just wasn't there. Hitler had played around, you know, with keeping it back because they'd still been convinced.
They still thought there would be a landing in Calais.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And they you know, so that was a brilliant dimension, by the way, of D-Day, wasn't it? But I think we've got to accept that, or I would believe that Monty understood the risks, and his plan was resilient enough by putting so many more people in and on a wider front that he could probably manage it. But there was a lot of luck. I mean, do not forget the importance of air. And the German army, just as Rommel had feared, as soon as it started moving in any strength, they were spotted and neutralized. So if that hadn't been the case, then Rommel might, with just one panzer division, might have made things much more difficult. But basically, Monty's planning was sufficiently good to cater for most of those risks, even though I have to say I agree totally with you, it was extremely risky as an operation as well.
It was. And the Battle of Normandy goes on for 77 days, and the British Second Army, that he's then commanding, is holding off most German counterattacks to allow Omar Bradley's First Army to the west to clear the Cotentin Peninsula and secure Cherbourg. And so the British are taking most of the heat. Mm. And he keeps trying to break out in Operation Epsom and then Operation Goodwood. He keeps saying everything's going according to plan. It was going to one version of the plan, but he wouldn't explain it. No. And people got very angry with him. And Churchill was almost going to sack him for effectively insubordination. Mm.
Well, I think this is where commander's intent and explaining that to Churchill, amongst others, was so important, and he didn't bother to do it. As you know, he was a very arrogant man. Yeah. He wanted to be left alone to do it, and he wouldn't concede that it wasn't going to most people's idea of the plan, and his own timings were way out. I mean, he hoped to capture Caen, I think, on day one.
On day one, yeah.
And it took another month and a half. So, all that did not help. And this is where his brilliance as a military commander is so let down by his personality. Mm. If only he'd been a generous-hearted man, which is why, of course, when you compare them, Slim always gets the soldiers' vote, because he seemed to be generous-hearted and a good bloke, whereas Monty wouldn't give credit to anybody else, even when people gave him credit, he didn't take it in the way that one would hope others might.
He used to say he was as quick as a ferret and about as likeable.
Yeah, I suspect there was something in it, but I think if you worked for him, if you were in his command, then that was a different issue, because people like a winner. And although his affection for self-publication, all that stuff detracts from him, actually within his army and in the eyes of his enemies, that was important too. Yeah. And of course, we're not instinctively military people don't really like doing that. But even my own very limited experience compared to in Afghanistan, it was important the Afghans felt in me they had a winner. Well, the only way they could feel that is through their access to the media or big meetings, just the stuff that Monty was doing. So I think he understood that well before most military people.
Yeah, and speaking about being a winner, let's move on to Arnhem, Operation Market Garden, because this is very much Monty's show. He's determined to cross the Rhine, to be the first to cross the Rhine and the what's commonly known as the Bridge Too Far, and to seize nine bridges with the airborne and then to have an armoured thrust right through to cross the Rhine in some sort of force early on. And it's so unlike Montgomery, this operation. And you think, was that his ego getting the better of him? Or was it a risk worth taking? I mean, people still argue about Operation Market Garden.
I think they
will. You must
have
lectured on it many times.
Yes, I actually used to take the Staff College Battlefield Tour to Arnhem. So I do feel I know a bit about it, and I brought in an American, Moffat Burrus, and Sergeant Robinson, and Lord Peter Carrington, and all that. So I know a bit about the tactical level. But I've obviously, like you, I've studied the operational strategic levels. Would I have done it? I don't know. If they had pushed on, of course, they didn't really get it. As an army, we didn't really understand commander's intent in that period. Remembering they'd fought a hell of a battle, so it's all very forgivable. But I think if I was Monty, I think I would have probably given it a go. But there's no doubt that wrapped up in the overall decision was a lot of ego. He did not want the Americans and Bradley and Patton, his bete noire, gaining the glory of getting across the Rhine, which was Eisenhower's preferred strategy on broad front, as you bring out so well in the book. He threw his last ace there, really, I think. I mean, it came, he then save the American army in the Ardennes, the Battle of the Bulge, in many respects, subsequently to that. But I think it was always a long shot, but probably worth going for with a little bit of luck turning it in other ways.
Everybody needs luck. If they'd been a bit more lucky, It might have worked, but it didn't.
It didn't. And so I, these people say, well, it would nearly work. No, it either worked or it didn't.
Yeah.
And the people of Arnhem suffered hugely that winter as a result. All those sort of very negative things.
But you mentioned the Battle of the Bulge. This is the Ardennes offensive, the German final throw in the West. And because over Christmas in 1944, the Americans were at sixes and sevens, and Patton in the South sort of saves their bacon a bit. Mm. But Montgomery, I mean, Eisenhower asks Montgomery to be responsible for the American 1st and 9th Armies, 200,000 troops. In fact, he doesn't have to do very much, but my goodness, it doesn't half feed his ego to be given command of two American armies to sort them out and hold them together, which he does very well. Mm.
No, I think, in many respects, that it wasn't his finest battle, we could debate that, but it was a hugely important one. And we forget the size of the armies that the Germans put together for the Battle of the Bulge. And the fact it was contained in that way, I think, Monty's resilience and calmness, little bit of movement of troops required, but not a lot. But he just steadied it up. Of course, he couldn't help but lord it over the Americans as a result. And so subsequently, they liked him even less because he should have been, more generous-hearted about it. It just happened that you can never be strong everywhere. Bradley had thinned out on the Ardennes, just like the French had in 1940. With the benefit of hindsight, it was wrong. But I think it was one of Monty's finest moments, even though the ego got in the way again.
Mm. What, David, you have commanded forces, not as big as those that Montgomery commanded, but not lacking in comparison. You commanded all British forces in Sierra Leone, and you commanded British and allied forces in Afghanistan, and you know what combat is like, and you know what it's like to command in combat. What's your sense of the legacy of Montgomery? Would you have liked to have been one of his soldiers? Would you have been confident if you'd been a major when he was a general?
Yes. I think if I was in one of his armies, most notably 8th Army, I would have had, a swagger in my tail, whatever the right word is.
My dad was one of his national servicemen, and to the end of his life, my father talked of him as my boss.
Yeah.
He was proud to be a member of one of Montgomery's armies.
Mm. I think that was very common, and I've spoken to veterans of that era, sadly, most have died, who felt that. I mean, the old school didn't like him, because, he didn't act like a gentleman. But I think even that school, and my wife Caroline's father served under him, and I used to talk to him about it. And he was old school in many respects, but he did respect him hugely. And I think it's sort of respect, gratitude that they're under the command of someone who understood their business. I mean, under Monty, you got your orders and you did as you were told. Up till then, many times you've heard that people would say, well, orders were a basis for discussion. Well, not with Monty. He taught it all through. He was a master of planning and of detail. And on the whole, his plans worked out pretty well. And I think this great understanding of what he could ask his army to do and what he shouldn't ask them to do is the defining bit of Monty. And I only wish that would play out all the way through today, because too often, I mean, I've suffered a bit from this. You're asked to do things that your army can't do, either because it's not been properly trained or it hasn't got the right equipment, hasn't got enough numbers, most notably, far too few people in places like Afghanistan and Iraq. So I think Monty, his great legacy, if only we applied it more consistently and our political masters understood it, is to work and operate within your capacity to achieve your mission, if you want, your aim. And that is the big takeaway for me of undoubtedly, I have to say, whatever else one says, and look at other great generals like Slim, was in the round our greatest World War II general.
Yeah, I mean, some say, I mean, Montgomery and Slim are some of our greatest generals in the 20th century between them. Totally different characters, quite Monty different. And Slim, but both of them were extraordinarily effective in their own ways.
Yes, I mean, whether it's interesting to contemplate whether Montgomery would have succeeded in Southeast Asia and Burma in the way Slim did. I don't think there's any reason to think he wouldn't have done, because he'd have brought the same qualities and that focus on planning. I think Slim's ability to... My father was in the 14th Army. He worshipped Slim, you know, because of one or two times he met him, there was that soldier's commander rapport, which is very rare. Yeah. But I suspect in different ways Monty had that too. But there was an arrogance about Monty, which I suspect his success and reputation sort of allowed him to survive. Whereas Slim, there was an affability about him, a sort of blokishness, that, although he was a hard man in many respects, that people naturally loved. So of the two, and I think they are our greatest field commanders of the Second World War, I suspect it would be very difficult, but your job, and you do to some degree do this in your book, judging who is the better is a forlorn task. Yeah, they're quite different, and we were very lucky to have both of them.
Yeah. Through your career, your very successful military career, did you ever consciously draw lessons from Montgomery?
Yes, and that particular, my point about capacity to achieve the aim, which is why, you know, sometimes I was criticised for being, you know, protesting too much to my political and indeed senior military commanders, particularly in Afghanistan.
And then again in Libya.
And then in Libya, I fell out a bit with David Cameron. We got on and did it, but we were being asked to do things that we didn't have the capacity to do. And of course, to some degree, you find ways round it. You've got ingenious staff who come up with solutions. Okay, well, we can compensate for that failing doing that. But I think that's the big lesson I learned from Monty is you've got to have the capacity to do the task, or you must at least make sure people understand where the flaws might be. And then you've got to have the moral courage, and I think it's moral courage, to say to your bosses what you think is the truth, i.e. speak truth unto power. I'm sure I didn't always get that right, but if I have a reputation of anything, I think it is that I probably overdid it sometimes and I should have turned to the right and got on. But, you know, sometimes when I was in Afghanistan, I saw the confusion and lack of preparedness on the part of the nations contributing to ISAF to give us the forces, anything like the forces we required. I often think, actually, would Monty put up with that? Or would Slim put up with it? Would even the more docile in some respects, I've got a very high regard for Alexander, I don't think any of those men would have done. And it definitely did encourage me as I went to bed that night. What am I going to do? Sacker's coming tomorrow. I've got to tell him the truth. And then I got in a bit of trouble for it. But I learnt those lessons. If I didn't instinctively feel them, knowing history and reading about these people undoubtedly helped hugely.
Just coming back to this building where we are now, I mean, this was the scene of a very decisive moment in British and world history, the decision to invade the continent and begin the process of liberating Europe from Nazi tyranny. In your military career, I'm thinking of particularly Sierra Leone, did it ever come down to a moment of shall I, shan't I? Did it ever come down to anything, not as big as this, of course, but at that dramatic moment, is that are we going to do it or not? Was there a single moment in your operational career that was dramatic in that sense?
Sierra Leone was a moral issue for me in many respects. I had been there the year before and seen what the RUF had done to the population. And when we were sent out to do an evacuation and leave the Sierra Leoneans to it, that I couldn't tolerate. And knowing that even though we didn't have very large forces, that I could construct a big enough force.
You felt you could do it.
I was convinced we could do it because I understood my enemy. That's another very important thing that Monty possesses, a quality understood. So very early on, I decided I was going to go for it, even though we didn't really have any orders to do that. And then I played the media card to get messages back to London, because I couldn't, I believe it, I had no direct link with the Prime Minister, although he just signed the order to get put me out there. But he didn't really understand what was happening until much later on, days later. So I think, yes, early on, probably day one, the day I arrived, I decided...
You knew you were going to do it.
I knew I was going to do it.
Sitting here in Southwark House, if you and I sit very quietly, David, do you, like me, hear the ghosts whispering to you?
Very much so. I feel it's fantastic we're here, and well done, BFBS, for coming here. But the knowledge, as I said right at the beginning, that Eisenhower has walked around here, Monty, Tedder, you know, Group Captain Stagg, all these people I've read about, I'm in their presence in many ways, and it's a great, great privilege. Thank you for inviting me.
General Lord David Richards, thank you for speaking to me.